Okay. Thank you very much. I'm very happy to be here and to be able to stay here for a year and learn about many new things. So today I would like to tell you about some attempts that we did basically with Giorgio Parisi and some other people I will mention on the way to try to describe the physics of structural glasses. And so I will try to be rather general and leave the details aside for more private conversation afterwards. So let me start describing a bit in general term what are glass phases. There are several types of glass phases, and you can find them in many different types of systems. If you have a system of particle and you cool it fast enough, generically it will freeze. The particle will freeze in some kind of random positions. Locally there seems to be some kind of order, but then you realize that there is no long-range order, but the particles are frozen in the sense that they will rattle in some local cage, and I will try to make that more precise afterwards. And this kind of behavior is ubiquitous. You can always, nearly all systems, if you cool them fast enough, or you could also increase the density, or there are several ways of getting to the glass phase, they will have this behavior. And it's also seen in some systems which are systems of spins, and these are the spin glasses. In spin glasses, the situation is a bit different, in the sense that it's somewhat easier. If you consider, for instance, the archetype of spin glasses, which is copper manganese, in which you have some manganese impurities in copper diluted, then you have the positions of the impurities which are frozen, and each carries a spin, and you will have some interactions between the spins, which depends on the distance. And then if you cool this system, the spins will freeze in some random directions. So it's a bit different in the sense that you have some what we call quenched-in disorder, namely the positions of the particle are frozen. Okay, and they do not diffuse. It's only the spin degrees of freedom. So the spin degrees of freedom here are coupled to a quenched random field. While in the problem of structural glasses, you don't have this. It's a problem where the disorder gets self-induced. You don't have a disorder a priori. And so you have many other systems which show some glass phases. I mean, the people have described it in, for instance, in proteins, where if you look at the native state of a protein, it is a state which is compact and in which the global shape is frozen also. Or it has been very useful for the description of neural networks, or even some aspects of social science. I don't know, maybe some case one could describe the attitude of a congress as freezing in some kind of completely random direction, but that depends on political issues and taste. So today I want to concentrate on structural glasses and particularly those which are simple enough in their microscopic description. That would be a set of particles which interact by pair, for instance. So it would have an energy which is just something of this type, which is a sum of pair interactions, where the interaction potential could be anything more or less realistic, which would have a short-range core. Maybe it could be a Lennard-Jones, for instance, system, or it could be soft spheres, like one of our R12 potential, or it could be hard spheres or something like that, anything of this type.
So the glass phase may not be the ground state, because if you have Lennard-Jones or something, I would not examine them closely.
Coming to it. Okay. So, in fact, the first thing, for anybody who works on glasses, the first thing is to avoid crystallization. So this can be done in several ways. Either you have the rate of cooling, which is a device. I mean, you could take anything. If you cool it fast enough, it will freeze in a random, it will freeze in a glass state. That's one possibility. Another possibility is to use a potential which is a bit more sophisticated than the one I have written here, which is a potential which will naturally frustrate the natural crystalline order, I mean. And for instance, one which has been very useful in for people particularly doing simulations, because in simulation they use short time, so they have a very, very fast cooling rate. So they use something which is called binary mixtures. And for instance, so you can take binary mixtures of one of our 12 particles with different radii, and if the radii are different enough, then the FCC lattice is frustrated, basically, and you don't converge into it. So that will. So the lesson from that, I will not talk to that much about the crystal, because the crystal, I think, has not much to do with the glass phase itself. And the thing that you have to keep in mind is just that there are several ways of avoiding the crystal, and there are some systems in which the pair potential that you put in is frustrated enough that you won't see the crystal. So that's. So you can forget about it. So how do you see the glass? So I will be very sketchy. I mean, all this, I should say, it's a very vast field, and I am not trying to give an overview of it. I would not be able to, probably. And so I will just give some sketch of the main ideas which are useful to my discussion. So how you see the glass transition, for instance, there are several ways of seeing it. One very intuitive way is to look, for instance, people have looked in details in simulations at the following objects. You look at a given particle and how at its displacements at time t, and you can look at its displacement squared versus time in a log-log plot. And what you find is that at short enough time there is a t squared behavior, which is a ballistic behavior. Then it starts to saturate. And then, depending on the temperature, at some time it will start to diffuse with a certain diffusion coefficient, d times t. And that's what you see in a simulation very well, and that you see that at a certain temperature, t1. And the thing that happens if you go to a lower temperature is that this plateau region will increase, and the diffusion will start on a much longer time scale. So it's called, again, there is a two steps relaxation in which you have a short distance, a certain short distance behavior, then a saturation at the plateau, and then a diffusion. And the pictorial image that one has about that is, of course, that you have a particle which is here, which rattles in a cage. And then at some time, it will be able to leave the cage and go to some other place. And that will be this time scale which appears here. So this is the basic image of the behavior of one particle, let's say. And this can be seen also in the similar effects of two steps relaxation can be seen very well in experiments by light diffraction and so on. Sorry?
For all temperatures, the plateau, it's about the same.
You draw all the. Oh, it has a very small dependence on the temperature, the cage. So this plateau is basically the cage size, let me call it A or whatever. It gives you the square, this is the square of the radius of this cage. And it will depend weakly on temperature, yes. I have simplified a bit the thing. So.
And you mentioned the glass transition before you do this, but you haven't told us yet what the glass transition is in terms of these behaviors.
Okay. I'm coming to it. So the main thing is basically, is there a transition or not? That's one very important question. And is there a phase transition? And one question that you could ask is whether if you go to low enough temperature, this plateau becomes infinite or not. Basically, that's one way of thinking about it, that if it becomes infinite, it means that the particle is trapped for infinitely long time. And that's whether there is a phase transition or not is a very debated question. And the thing that you have to look at is look at the relaxation time. So if you look at the relaxation time and... let me say, so people, there is a special relaxation time, which is the time scale of a typical experiment, let's say, which would be 100 seconds or something like that. So let me plot it that way. Let me plot the log of the relaxation times in unit of 100 seconds versus the temperature. And in fact, people tend to plot it versus Tg over T, where Tg is the glass temperature. Let me do the plot and explain it a bit better. I have defined a glass temperature Tg by the fact that the relaxation time will be of order 10 to the 2 second. So that's completely that's a pure convention, and it's a very anthropomorphic one, actually, but that's what has been done, let's say. And then in terms of this definition, so by definition here I have Tg over T equals 1. And then I can look at various glass-forming materials and investigate their relaxation time versus temperature.
And what is the operational definition,
or precise
definition of relaxation time?
I would need to enter a bit more in the details. But basically, you could deduce it from viscosity measurement, let's say. If you look more in the literature, you would instead of taking the relaxation time divided by 100 seconds, you would say when the viscosity reaches the conventional value, which is 10 to the 13 quads.
But there are some well-defined exponential processes, whatever they are, which can be defined with respect to a tau, characteristic tau. Is that what it is?
Sorry?
Are there some well-defined exponential processes which are characterized by tau? I mean, to have a characteristic time,
yes, sir,
you need some exponential processes.
Well, as I said, one way of investigating it is measuring viscosity and then extracting a time by using a relatively high frequency shear modulus to relate the shear modulus allows you to relate a time scale with a certain viscosity scale.
And in that context, I have a very simple question.
Yes.
What is the difference between what you're calling glass? In this picture, there isn't any. It's just a disorder system.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the way you described it, all disorder systems are glasses, according to that definition we have.
Yes.
Is that true, or is glass, are there disorder systems? I mean, glass is one type of disorder system, but are all disorder system glasses? Are all amorphous system glasses? I mean,
well, I would tend to say an amorphous solid state, I would like to call it a glass.
Okay.
But maybe then we can discuss on a case-by-case basis if there is it shares a basic property I like or not. So then you can look at various systems and draw this plot of the relaxation time versus 1 over the temperature in correct units. So by definition, they all go here. And then there are very different types of systems, and people have classified it. And there is this classification, which is due to Angel, I think, which is that there are some systems which show a log of tau, which is just a linear function of 1 over T. And that is very natural. That's a pure Arrhenius law. And an archetype of this system is just silica, amorphous SiO2. And then you see that it is just a pure Arrhenius law. And generically, these glass formers are network forming glasses in which you have some local network building up. And then there are some other systems which show a very non-Arrhenius behavior, which is something of this type. And so there are many of these, and one which has been very much investigating experimentally is CKN with calcium, potassium, and NiO2 ions. And then you have all these systems that I was talking about. If you take these binary Lennard-Jones binary hard spheres and so on, or soft spheres, fall into this category. So, and these are called the fragile glass formers for some reason that I don't know. It's very impressive that in these fragile glass formers, in some instance, you can have the systems which, when you move the temperature by 10% above Tg down to Tg, you get an increase of 10 orders of magnitude of the relaxation time. So it is really a very, very strong effect. And in these systems, for this one it's not useful, but for this one very often the relaxation time has been fitted as something like a law which will be something like that, which is a Fogel-Fulcher-Talman law, which has not very much justification in itself, but it can allow you to give a good fit to the data. And of course in the fragile glass former, the thing that happens is that you have a T0 which is less but not very far from the glass transition temperature defined as a convention here. So this points towards if this fit is true, and that's only a fit, and I mean you cannot prove that there is a phase transition if you have no theory behind, because experimentally you cannot get close enough. So if this fit is correct, it hints that there is a phase transition somewhere, that there is a diverging relaxation time at some temperature, which is this Fogel-Fulcher temperature T0. And so that is so. Of course, from this point of view, the SiO2 is not is one in which you don't expect to have a phase transition, at least not one at finite temperature, let's say. So I will concentrate more on fragile glass former. And then the next piece of general introduction I want to give is also some remark which was due to Kautzmann 50 years ago, actually, which in which he was looking at the entropy of the liquid. Actually, of the supercooled liquid, because you have to avoid the crystallization. So you follow the liquid from high temperature, you cross the temperature of crystallization by some device, who cross it fast enough, and so on. You avoid crystallization, and you look at the entropy of the supercooled liquid minus the entropy of the crystal, and you find that this vanishes when you decrease the temperature at a temperature which is a Kautzmann temperature, which is close to T naught. So this is the second piece of evidence that at least something, of course you do not want to have a system which has a liquid which has an entropy less than that of the crystal, so it tells you that something has to happen. Okay, the thing that has to happen is not necessarily a phase transition, but at least qualitatively this curve, you cannot continue it smoothly as it was going. So all this points towards the possible existence of a phase transition at this temperature. And this phase transition, it has been called the ideal glass transition. So I have nothing to say about the existence or not of a phase transition from a rigorous point of view. I mean, that's an extremely hard problem. Even in the case of spin glasses, which is much better understood and has been much more worked on, there is a good mean field theory and so on and so forth. But in any finite dimension, nobody has been able to prove that there is a spin glass phase, I mean, prove in mathematical terms. So this is clearly the kind of problem that is very hard, and I will not say anything about this, except that I will assume that this is correct, that there is in fact an ideal glass transition at this temperature T0. That is, in experiments you don't reach really T0, you stop at some slightly higher temperature, and then I will try to within this framework I will explain you how one can compute some properties of the glass phase and in fact compute some temperature like this T0, by assuming it exists, one can compute it and then compare to the numerics and to things like that. So that will be how I will proceed.
Can there be a question to definition? Because you said before that your glassy state is an amorphous state or disorder state, this practice of saying.
Yes.
But then you are saying that nobody has proved that you have a glassy state. But if you have a disordered state, it could be a ground state. We know, for instance, for some exact solutions, simply you have as a ground state a disordered state.
Yes, sure.
It's okay. Why you're saying here that this has never been proved? If you put the equalization sign between these two states. What do you mean, actually, by...
Okay, so I should be more precise. It depends a bit on the system. It's true that there are some model systems in which you can prove that the ground state is a kind of random state, and then you have to define what is random, but I will not go into that. What I just had in mind, for instance, take the simple problem of Hart spheres. The problem of Hart spheres, and you may ask in three dimensions what is the densest packing of Hart spheres, and that is a very old problem, which is Kepler's problem actually, and people have been working on that since Kepler, more or less, and it's still open. And the conjecture of Kepler is that the FCC density is the highest one, but nobody is able to prove that there is no random packing which would have a higher density so far.
I thought the mathematicians just proved that.
Well, I mean, at least I was visiting the website of one of the people who is an expert in the field 2 weeks ago, and he had not yet proven it, so maybe it was, or it is very, very recent if it is, maybe it's last week or something like that.
No.
Okay, anyhow, that is what I was referring to, in the sense that it's very difficult to prove something like that. And then, even like that, for a physicist, then it's even more complicated. That is, proving that the ground state is an amorphous packing is one thing, but proving that there is a finite temperature phase transition is another thing. And that is even more, much more complicated. So from this point of view, rigorous proof is far away.
Beyond the rigorous proof, what would you say about low temperature phase?
That
low T0, suppose you have
a fragile system.
Yes.
And what is relaxation?
Well, I will talk about that. Okay. So, in fact, in order to address this question, first of all, the thing that I would like to mention is that if it is a transition, it is a transition which is slightly unusual in the following sense. That of course, the other parameter that you would like to define is just this cage radius. So that is a very natural definition of the other parameter. It jumps discontinuously at the transition because it's infinity. It's infinite in the liquid phase and becomes finite. So this seems to be that the transition would be some kind of first order like transition. On the other hand, if you look at the thermodynamics, it is not at all first order. The free energy, the entropy, etc. are continuous. The specific heat has a jump. So it seems that thermodynamically, it is second order.
Is this experimental information?
Yes. The jump of CP is something which is very well documented. There is a largest jump for fragile glasses, and it's something. It jumps from a value which is a typical liquid-like value to a typical crystal value. And the CP of the glass is very, very close to that of the crystal. Okay. And so you don't see there is no latent heat. So you don't see a first-order phase transition, but you see a jump in the order parameter in some sense. So that is a bit unusual already. And so because of this, several years ago have put forward some analogy between this system and certain types of spin glasses. And so I would like to make a small detour towards spin glasses. I apologize, it will be a bit difficult to follow, but there will be 5 or 10 minutes of spin glasses before we get back to the real glass problem. Just because, in some sense, the whole approach that we did is somewhat inspired from this analogy with spin glasses. It's not so that it's technically very different, but at least some general ideas are the same. Okay, so in spin glasses, the problem. Spin glass is a difficult problem, but it is simpler. And it is simpler at least in one respect, in the sense that there is a well-established mean field theory, and that is which has been much worked upon in the last 15 or 20 years. And so at the mean field level already one starts really to understand the thing quite well. And it turns out that in mean field spin glasses, there exist some systems which exhibit this kind of strange behavior with this kind of strange phase transition, and these let me call them discontinuous. Discontinuous spin glasses. And a simple example of that is a system of Ising spins, which interact, so I have SI equal plus or minus 1, it could be spherical spin, doesn't matter that much, which interact by, instead of interacting by pairs, they interact by p-uppers. And they have some random quenched interaction. And if this interaction is long range, it turns out that you can solve this problem exactly and find that there is a phase transition. And in fact, I'm glad to say that the first such system which was solved, we did with David 15 years ago, something like that, when he was visiting Paris. And so this is called the P-spin model in the jargon, doesn't matter that much. What does one find in this kind of problem? First of all, the exact solution of it shows that above TC, the system is a paramagnet. There is no spontaneous magnetization. The expectation value of the spin is zero. Here I am always talking of a problem which is at thermal equilibrium. So this means really Boltzmann average. I will maybe, if I have some time at the end of the talk, I will discuss a bit more the dynamical aspects, which are very interesting, but it's a whole other world.
Exactly what you're talking about now, not a mean field theory, right?
It's a mean field, if this becomes long range, infinite range actually, then this is exactly solved, and it's a mean field system. Okay? So in this sense it is exact. Now what happens is that for T less than the critical temperature, the spins acquire a spontaneous magnetization. This spontaneous magnetization, so they will tend, each spin will tend to point in a favored direction. And this direction, it is something which is random, in the sense that you don't have a ferromagnetic order. The total magnetization is zero. And in fact, the thing which is very nice is that in this system you have a lot of possible equilibrium states. I mean, the system can polarize in one spontaneous direction or another one. So I should really put an index alpha saying in what state the system has polarized. So you, the thing that you have to in order to visualize that, you have to think about phase space. Let me... let me draw it. Imagine that this is phase space. This is your 2 to the n hypercube, or it could be the sphere if you take spherical spins, let's say. And then in this system, what you have is that if you look at the, now you look at all the configurations, and let me draw what configurations are accessible, have a non-zero Boltzmann probability in this low temperature phase, and they will draw some kind of pockets like that, which are the states. Which are not accessible, there is no possibility to go from one to the other. So this is the state alpha. It contains a certain number of configurations. And these states, it has a certain free energy, which I could define as the sum of all the configuration in the state e to the minus beta ec is equal to e to the minus beta f. That defines the free energy of the state. So you have all these states, they are uncorrelated with one with the other, actually they are like random points in a high dimensional space, that is that generically their scalar product is zero, they are very far away, and so your system will polarize in one of these regions of phase space. That is how it does, and it is a discontinuous transition in the sense that if you monitor what is the value of this object, which is what people call the Edwards-Anderson order parameter, versus temperature. It is zero at high temperature, and then at TC, it jumps discontinuously, and then it reaches one at low temperature if you have an Ising system. So the system really polarizes pretty well, and in some instances, this thing can be quite close to one. So it is a really very discontinuous phase transition, but it has this nice feature that there is no discontinuity of the free energy and the entropy, and just a jump in the specific heat. So it has this kind of behavior that was found in the other system. And basically the reason why it does that, it's rather easy to understand, is the following. Turns out you can look in this system at the distribution of all the states, and you can count the number of states which have a certain free energy density equal to a certain value f. And this grows exponentially with the size of the system, so it grows with something which I call an entropy, and which is called the configurational entropy. Now this configurational entropy, it has the following behavior. It depends a bit on the temperature, but at one given temperature, it is something of this type. So now you may understand how the freezing goes in the following sense, that let me try to compute the partition function in this system. It is just the sum of all the states e to the minus beta da free energy. And this I can immediately write as the integral of all the possible free energy density e to the n sc of f minus f over t. And this by saddle point, I can find where the dominant states lie, and the dominant states lie at a certain free energy, which is such that the saddle point of this is dc. Derivative of the configurational entropy with respect to f equal 1 over t. So these are the states which dominate my partition function, and then if I cool my system, I have, so the slope here is 1 over t. If I cool my system, I go to the dominant state, have a lower and lower free energy until I reach here this critical point. And this critical point, it has a certain slope, and this slope is 1 over tc. Once I reach this temperature, then I am confined to the states which are these ones, which dominate my partition function. And that is the phase transition in these systems. Okay, and again, in this kind of system, it's something that you can work out in all details, and in fact... With zero entropy here. Zero configurational entropy. Sorry, yes, that's a good one comment about that. Of course, these formulas, they all look very familiar, of course, because it looks like I'm doing exactly the same thing that I would do by going to energy, from energy to free energy in some sense. But you have to understand that I have done one step when I do all that. I have decomposed the entropy in two pieces. There is an entropy which comes from the number of configuration inside one state. That is the kind of internal entropy of my state. Okay, and that's why I'm always writing free energies of the state. The state has a certain energy and a certain internal entropy. Okay, and then there is an extra piece to the entropy which comes from the existence of very many of these states, an exponentially large number, and this is the configurational entropy. And that is very important because actually people in glasses have been using exactly this notion of configurational entropy for many years, and it is exactly the same thing that happens in glasses. So, and here this decomposition, of course, that I am saying that if I look at the total free energy, let me call it e to the minus beta n phi, I get that the total free energy is the minimum over f of the internal free energy minus t times the configurational entropy. Okay, so I've done the same decomposition as one does, let's say, by going from energy to free energy. I have done an extra decomposition of the entropy between an internal piece and a configurational piece. So this is exactly how the transition goes in these systems, and again, it's something that can be studied in a lot of details, and there are even now some rigorous proof of all this and so on. So it is something that has been well studied. Now, because of that, some people 10 years ago or something like that, people like Kirkpatrick, Tirumalai, Volines, have proposed a kind of bold assumption or analogy or something like that. And they noticed that there is a strong analogy between the kind of results that one gets in these discontinuous spin glasses and the real glasses. And in fact, there is some analogy. There is the fact that this transition is discontinuous but second order. There is the fact that it also explains this Kautzmann paradox I was mentioning about the vanishing of the entropy. You see that it is something that you will find exactly the same here. So it has some kind, it explains the jump in specific heat. It also explains, if you go to dynamics, I have no time so far to discuss the dynamics, but it explains some very nice things of the dynamics, like the shouldering with this two-step relaxation that I was mentioning before. If you work out the dynamics of this system, it has exactly the same. And in fact, when you work it out in details, you find some equation describing these dynamics above TC, which are exactly the mode coupling equation that people have been using to fit the data, experimental data on structural glasses. So it has some good analogy, and so it is... That's a very... They are not inside the state. They are somewhere else. If you put this system inside a state, it will stay here forever. It will have exponential relaxation. The problem is that you are not able to thermalize the system, which means you are not able to find the configuration which is inside the state. So if you start from some initial configuration, it turns out that you get this two-step relaxation. That's okay. Maybe I postpone this question on the dynamics towards the end of the talk. If I have some time, I will discuss the dynamics. So, yes,
these things, in order for to establish this analogy, are these things have to be discrete or can actually?
Oh, no, not at all. No, there are many such models, actually. This is one, but you could have... for instance, the simplest one from the computational point of view is this version where you have just a spherical constraints like sum of ISI squared equal n. That's a spherical model, and it has a spin glass transition of this type, and so on. Okay. More questions, maybe? No?
So, I mean, are you going to explore this a little bit more because...
Yes.
Okay.
Sure.
This is not very,
So, thank you very much. So, in fact, this is very nice, but it is a pure analogy, and you cannot do very much out of it. I mean, in a sense, you cannot compute, predict, or something like that. And so, because of this, we thought that it would be a good idea to try to attack, let's say, the glass problem directly. Keeping in mind this picture, because it's... So basically the thing that I will do now is explain you this work that we did with Giorgio Parisi about trying to attack directly from first principle this problem of the glass transition. And we will work within this kind of scenario. That is, I will assume that there is a transition and that it is of this type. And then I will show you how one can really compute something and then compare to some observations, let's say. Okay. Of course, yes, because this analogy, it has some nice features, but it has also something which is very bad. For instance, I insisted at the beginning that in structural glasses there is no quench disorder, while in spin glasses there is quench disorder. In fact, the models I have shown you, they have quench disorder. So this looked like a very basic, I mean, something which is really fundamentally different. And one step which was taken in the 94 or something like that was some groups of people found out that there exist spin glasses which have no Quenchin disorder, which have no randomness in the Hamiltonian, and which have a very nice spin glass behavior. And this I could tell you about it, but I will not do it now. So because of that, I mean, all this after some time took some time to have a maturation, but then we decided that it was needed to go directly to the glass problem. And the thing that we have been working on so far is the statics, which is the properties of the system at equilibrium, at the Boltzmann equilibrium. And there are a lot of questions that one can ask whether it is possible or not to reach the equilibrium. The answer will be no, but let us first work out the same, and the answer is also no in these spin glass models. So it's a first step, and then we have to go to the dynamics, let's say. And this will be done later. Okay, so the question is very simple. I go back to my old problem. I have a system of interacting particles with this Hamiltonian which is here. I take the potential I prefer, and I would like to try to compute if there is a phase transition, the properties, and so on and so on and so forth. So the first question that one has to discuss is the question of an order parameter. Because if I have no dynamics, it's not so easy to define this cage radius and so on. And so I would like to have really a thermodynamic order parameter for my problem. So how do I do that? That is the main problem. Imagine that I would have a crystal. If I would like to study the crystalline phase, and I really want to study it from first principle like that, then in a crystal, I know what is going to happen. I know that I have a spontaneous breakdown of translation symmetry, if I want to use very big words for a simple fact like that. And so my particle will polarize in some positions which are well known, which are the node of some Bravais lattice, depending on the potential, let's say an FCC lattice. And so one thing that I could do is work out the really statistical mechanics of this system by adding some small fraction to this lattice, point. I could add this small W, this W potential could be anything I like, let's say something like this. It should have some range which is small enough, smaller than the typical interparticle distance, so that each particle will fill only one of these wells. And so I could define an order parameter by looking at what is, let's say, for instance, the value of could compute the fluctuations of xi around its spinning point, take the large n limit, and then take the limit where the spinning potential is zero. And that's...
How do you choose the vectors ai in a specific implementation of this thing? Is that going to correspond?
Well, I have not tried to implement it there. I am talking of in principle, but I mean, in a crystal, it's not that much difficult. I mean, you have all the Bravais lattices. You can choose each of one in sequentially, and you have just to adapt the density. So you could could take the density and choose the best density so that the system will polarize nicely. So that is something that is. So that is the usual way one defines an order parameter in statistical mechanics. That is. And you have to take the nice order of commuting the limits, of course. So now this is good for a crystal. And then the question is how you do that for an amorphous solid state, of course. Because in an amorphous solid state, the very description of the order state is very complicated because I need to specify all these position ai, and I just don't have a simple recipe like in a crystal to do that. And in fact, it needs an infinite amount of information to characterize all the ai. So I'm not able to do that for an amorphous system, for a glass. So in a glass, the first idea that comes to mind, for people who had a background in spin glasses, the first idea which came to the mind was to say, okay, if we are not able to find the AI, the system knows where they will be. And so one way of doing that would be to say, let us take two copies of the system and try to polarize them one in front of the other. And if they, and then in the end, we will remove this interaction, and if they stick in front of one of the other, it means you are in the glass state. That is, let me, maybe I first write it and then I draw a small... So let me take two copies. I will take two copies, xi1 and xi2. These are exactly two systems of identical particles interacting. Both of them interact with the same potential. So the energy is just the sum from a equal 1 to 2. V of xia minus xja, and then I put some attraction so that the particles in the two systems attract each other slightly with this small short range potential. So the thing that I have done is that I have this first system which is like this, and then I have my second system, and I tend to attract each particle of the second system to the particles of the first one, and as they have some short-range repulsion, it means that each of them will attract only one of the other system. And then I take the thermodynamic limit, and in the end I take this attraction to zero. If my system, it's exactly like in the crystal, except that I have gotten around the problem of the definition of the AI and the choice of the AI. If the system is in a solid phase, then it means that they will just stick one to the other. I mean, they will not move infinitely far away. So the order parameter in this thing would just be something like that. I take xi1 minus xi2 squared. And in fact, more precisely, this would give me twice the square of the cage radius, because I have to imagine that xi... Okay, that's a technical point. Let's forget about the factor 2 if you want. I mean, I could explain it.
Yes? Somehow trying to avoid crystallization with this
Spirit. No. Crystal, I have forgotten about the crystal. There is no crystal. Imagine that I have taken a V in which the peak of the FCC lattice at the next nearest neighbor is something which has a very bad potential. I've put a small bump in my V so that by some trick I avoid the crystal. Or I take binary mixtures or something like that. I don't want to talk about the crystal.
You're not explicit about avoiding crystallization.
No, this has nothing to do with the crystal. Imagine that I have a system like a binary mixture in which the real equilibrium state is not the crystalline state, but it is a glass state. Okay. Then the problem that I have to address is not the problem of the crystal. The problem is the description of a solid phase. Okay. And so the thing my problem is that in principle, in vague term, I know very well what it means. It means that my system, my particle should polarize and should have some expectation value somewhere in the some localized positions. Okay. Now, of course, these localized positions, they are random. They are random, and there is a very large 10 to the 23 of them, so I cannot list them. And so what can I do with that? And so this is the trick that I show you, is just a trick to try to get around the problem of giving you the AI. I say, I'm not able to give it to you because it would take so much computer paper, and the ITP has not enough paper to print all these AIs. But instead of that, I give you two systems, and I couple one to the other. Very small coupling. Then I take the thermodynamic limit, and I release this coupling. If my system is in a fluid phase, then the particles will move around, and this thing will be infinity if it is in a fluid phase. If it is in a glass phase, then it means that my particle are just the two systems will just polarize in the same glass state, and then my particles will stay at a finite distance.
Another question. I mean, I
yes.
Even in the crystalline case, when you put the AIs on the side of a crystal rod, if one's at finite temperature, there would be vacancies.
Yes.
Vacancies, so your particles are still one arbitrary.
Yeah, it should be infinite at infinite time.
Okay, there is still there is okay.
Zero temperature, although.
That is true. There is a change of. That may be true. That I need to go to low temperature and avoid this kind of time scale in which I diffuse these things. But there is one point about that which I was a bit sloppy about, which is a technical point, but it has its importance here. That is, when I define properly, when I really do the computation, what I need to do, there is a certain invariance by permutation of the particles, of course. And in fact, you see that my coupling here, I have been careful to apply a coupling which does not break the indiscernibility of the particles. So in fact, to really define properly the order parameter, I have to take into account the possibility of having a permutation of the order problem. I mean, it's not the particle I in the second system which is in front of the particle I in the first system. It's a permutation of the particle I in the second system. And then if I do that, if I take snapshots of my system at various times, I will always have one particle, except at some very rare times, and with one particle sitting in front of the other.
It is exactly the question. Question. If you look at your definition,
yes,
it has index r.
Yes, sir.
It should not have.
Oh yes, yes.
It should be something. But if you sum over r and,
okay,
and divide by the number of particles, then rare.
Yes. Okay. I wanted to be. I wanted to avoid this technical thing, but the thing that I have to do is to have here an optimization of the permutation of the particles. Okay.
And I should disappear from definition too.
Oh yes, but that is okay. This I could I can take
sum over I
divided by n. Yes, 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 certainly.
Well, this can diverge, right? You can have a particle. This point, another particle, for some permutation, they're miles apart, and this makes this very big.
What is the question? I don't understand.
If you really, you know, literally speak to this,
you have to first minimize that.
First minimize. Mm-hmm. Okay. Mm-hmm. Okay.
Okay, so that is the first guess of another parameter, but I'm happy there is so much discussion about it, but it is wrong. So there is this problem of the permutation, but that is a thing that one can do. And then there is another problem about it, which is the problem of the configurational entropy, which is here. And that is why I kept this curve of configurational entropy, in the sense that now, okay, what do I have? I have a system which polarizes. So I have my two systems which will go into the same glass state. Now what I am computing is really this partition function now with two copies of my system. Let me call it Z sub 2. And so what I have now is that for each state I have my two copies which contribute e to the minus beta f alpha. So there is a factor 2 here. Okay, now I propagate it, and I know that now the thing that I have to compute is that I have a factor 2 here. Is I have one time the degeneracy, the number, the configurational entropy appears with a factor 1, and the free energy appears with a factor minus 2f over t. Okay. So that is a very big difference. And so it means that my total free energy is the mean over f of something which is f minus t over 2 times the configurational entropy. And that is bad. That is bad because it tells me that I am not weighting correctly my configurations. I don't pick up the correct saddle point which I should have at equilibrium. Okay. I mean, I'm just saying that something very trivial, that this integral here with a factor 2 is not dominated by the same saddle point as this integral with a factor 1. That is obvious. Okay. So the trick to get around that is something which actually was proposed, I think, for the first time in the to use that for glasses. It was proposed by Rémy Monasson, and it was to go from two copies to m copies. So how do I do that? Now, instead of taking two copies, I take m copies, so I go from a equal 1 to m. And now I have the sum over all pairs of copies. I put my small attracting potential. And I do the same thing as before. So what do I get when I do that? I get exactly the same thing here, but with a factor m. And so my total free energy gets a factor t over m.
What is your physical definition of a copy? What does it mean physically?
I take two copies of my system. I take one set of n particles and another set of
just
n particles.
Twice.
M times. Mm-hmm. M times. Mm-hmm. And then you see that, and now I will analytically continue to m going to 1. So now I would like, I tend to say that when the m is an integer, I like to call them copies, and by some historical reason, I would like to say that when I analytically continue it, I call them replicas, because that's what we use in disordered system. So I have m replicas, and now you see that if I look at this order parameter here, and I take one more limit m going to 1, then I am in business. Okay. And so that is the idea. And in fact, more than that, if I have phi as a function of m, it is something like the Legendre transform, or whatever you call it, of the configurational entropy SC of f. So if you are able to access to phi as a function of m, then you get the configurational entropy.
Now what's strange here is, unlike the spin masses, that here m the Hamiltonian makes sense for m equals 1.
Yes.
And yet you want to get a different
Yes, so in fact I was using replicas to provoke a bit the name replicas. You realize very soon that these are really extremely different from the one we use in disordered systems. In disordered systems, or people who have done disordered systems, you introduce replicas because you have Quenchin disorder, you have to average the free energy of a disorder. The free energy is the logarithm of the partition function. And you say that the logarithm of partition function, you compute it from z to the n average when n goes to 0. And that is a replica. So this is something very different. There is no Quenchin disorder, no logarithm of the partition function to compute or anything else. Okay. There is some, of course, some analogy in the sense that you still have several copies of your system and you compare one to the other. And that's where the two definitions. Yes. So, yes, in fact, I will be very interested in the limit m going to 1, but the basic thing that you have to look at here is that if I look at this expression, I find that my saddle point is a place where I pick up, I am dominated by the free energies such that this configurational entropy curve has a slope m over t. Okay. So now it's very good because it tells me that for a given m, the transition appears only for m over t equals 1 over tc. Yes, so just I finish this sentence and so this means m equal t over tc. So in fact, if I look at the function of m and the temperature, I have here my critical temperature and here the value m equal 1. And this whole region, in this whole region, I am dominated by the saddle point, which is here, so I am in the glass phase. And in this region here, I am in the liquid phase. So this is very good, because it tells us, it gives us a clue to how to compute some properties of the glass phase below the critical temperature. You just have to use a value of m which is smaller than 1. And approach through this phase here by doing some purely liquid computation. So you will do some computations in the liquid phase, and it will be purely, I mean, just like integral equations and all the kind of things that people do in the liquid, and deduce the properties of the glass by using this thing here. Yes, sorry, that was a question.
When you're defining this order parameter with just an arbitrary m,
yes.
So you need to take that limit m goes to 1. A lot of care has to be taken that the limit exists and is well defined. You've still got that written index with replica 1 minus, or copy 1 minus copy 2.
Yes.
And yet you're not going to be doing that when you take the limit. How do you deal with that in the actual definition of the order parameter for m, which is allowed?
Okay, I don't know if I have understood completely the question. I guess the question has to do with whether this object, I mean, okay, there is an assumption in what we have been doing when we implement, so this is the kind of general strategy that we have been using. And then when we have implemented it, of course you could have some very, very difficult things happening in the fact that you could have that xi1 minus xi2 square is not equal to xi1 minus xi3 or something like that, which is called replica symmetry breaking. Here we don't, we have just done the simple assumption, which is a thing which would be correct actually in if we would be looking at the discontinuous spin glasses, which is that in this framework you don't have replica symmetry breaking.
I guess you answered a question which was much more sophisticated than what I meant to ask. I'm asking something that's fairly low end, which is simply you wrote x1 minus x2.
Yes.
2 doesn't exist once you take the limit.
Ah. Okay, the problem of analytic continuum. Okay, you compute it for integer m, and let's hope that it is well behaved at infinity for m very large, and that you can continue it analytically.
You sort of if a numerical, you know, you can look at things and do the continuations. That can be really dangerous.
It can be very dangerous, but the kind of function that we have found are very simple functions of m. So it was not, I don't think it's a big problem. Okay, it's getting late, maybe I will have to... Okay, let me just, so this is a general problem, this is a general scenario, and the thing that we did is really to use that and try to compute the properties of the glass and compare to numerics, let's say. That is basically what we have been doing. So in practice it becomes then a bit more tedious, in the sense that you have to understand and compute with a dense liquid. You have to look at the liquid at a temperature which is a liquid of molecules, of M atoms. And these are dense liquids because, in fact, it's a liquid that you look at at a temperature which is close to the glass transition temperature. And so you have to be able to characterize this liquid well enough, let's say. So you have these small molecules, let's say M equals 3, like that. You have this liquid, and you have to be able to compute with this kind of thing here. So the thing that we, very briefly, let me explain you what we have been doing, let's say. Then at this stage it may well be that some experts in liquid theory will come up with results which are more precise than what we have got. We have just used some rather simple-minded approximation, but of course you have to do some approximation. At this stage so far, I mean, that was just a general formalism, and then you can use your favorite method to handle this problem of the liquid. But as we know, the problem of dense liquid, it is under control, but it is not totally obvious, and you need to go with some approximations, like integral equations or something like that. And so, okay, let me explain what we did. What we did is the following. We look at one of these molecules here, and it has the particles positioned, which are XIA. A is the replica index, and I is the particle index, up to the permutation, which I don't discuss here. And I decompose it as a center of mass, plus UIA. So here I have the center of mass. And so what I have to compute is really a partition function, which is an integral over the centers of mass and the internal coordinate, e to the minus beta, sum for I less than j, sum over replica, v of z I minus j, plus UIA minus UJA. And the thing that we have really worked out is a kind of Einstein model of the glass, if you want, in which basically what we have assumed is that if we want to understand the properties of the system in which you have a small cage radius, A small enough, then you can neglect anharmonicity and you can just look at the harmonic oscillations of the particle inside each well. And in this language, it means that you can just expand that to order U squared. When you expand that to order U squared, then you can do the U integral and you get something which is an effective action for a liquid of just the center of mass at the temperature beta M. At inverse temperature, beta M. Sorry. And if you look at what is the value of beta M, it is exactly the value of beta M, which will be interesting. It is just 1 over the glass transition temperature. So now the thing that we use, so for this liquid we use some HNC approximation. It could be sometimes could use something else if you prefer for the pair correlation and for the free energy. And with that we are able to compute this object. Once we have this object, we have this function phi as a function of M, and we can look at its properties. And so it is some kind of very Apernatic chain approximation. It's one of the standard integral equations for computing the correlation function in a dense liquid. Okay, that's, you could take the correlation function from numerics, from diffraction patterns that you from experiments. We did it just wanted to do it analytically for the fun of it, let's say. And so let me give you just briefly the results, some of the results, let's say.
Is it obvious that you need the internal degrees of freedom? You said molecules of an atom.
Yes.
You had talked about arc spheres forming glasses. But why are you feature necessarily molecular degrees of freedom if you talk about?
Well, I need these molecules because these are my, initially I have my system, then I introduce these M copies of the system. Then I argue, when I am in the glass phase, these M copies make bound state. These bound states are bound state of M atoms. And I need the dependence on M. That is very important to me. In fact, because I need to analytically continue as a function of M. Otherwise, I am lost. And if I do M equal 1 here, this is perfectly okay, but that's my original problem, and I don't know how to handle that problem directly.
Why
molecules
have a
non-why
internal degrees of freedom,
right?
Because
these are
they copies, those are real molecules, since calling them molecules.
Ah, sorry. Oh, yes, yes.
Sir.
In my replicated systems, these are, okay, these are single atoms. I have not, sorry, I apologize. In fact, yes, these are single atoms, but they are replicated and they form molecule in the other, in the replicate space. Okay, so what we get, so we have done the computations. Of course, here we were a bit, as we expand that, we were limited to soft potentials and not hard spheres. And so, yes.
The interaction between the copy is extremely weak, and you take the limit of this interaction going to zero. At
yes.
The end. So is it obvious that you should first consider the M copies forming a molecule, and then they exchange in the liquid, rather than the opposite, that one atom in the quote, molecule of M copy can exchange with the others? And
okay, that's a very good point. Actually, the first computation we did was 2 years ago, and we were doing exactly what you say. We were considering a gas which was a mixture of M species, and then we wanted to identify the transition temperature by the temperature starting from high temperature. Where do you develop correlations between different species, let's say. And that is a good way to identify the glass transition temperature. But then if you want to go into the glass phase, it turns out that the thing that happens is that you build up bound states, and so you have this molecule. So if you really want to describe the glass phase itself, you have to go beyond the simple atom of species. So that is, in fact, that was a crucial step that we had missed initially. So we studied a bit more in detail the case of V of R equals 1 over R to the 12. And in this case, of course, this has some scale covariance. So the thing, the scale-free parameter is the product of the density times temperature to the minus 1 quarter. And when you rescale the size of the box, you rescale the temperature, and you have this parameter. And so what we find is a critical value, which is 1.51. And if you look at the numerics, so the numerics has been done on mixtures to avoid crystallization. So it's mixtures of spheres with radius. The ratio of radius is equal to 1.2. So it's not exactly the same one. Now we are doing the analytic computation. It's not very difficult to do it for mixture, but we have not yet completed it, let's say. And so for mixtures, depending on the people and the fit and so on, they find a critical, the glass transition is something between 1.4 and 1.6. So we are just fall in the middle of it. The cage radius comes correct at 20% level also. And what else? There is one thing which is very nice, that when we go to the glass phase, we can look at the specific heat. And the specific heat, we find that it is equal to 3/2. And that has to be, of course, and that is something that is, it has to be, it is true, that's a Dulong and Petit law. It has to be because it's a solid, and but the thing that is, we were very very happy when we saw it come out, because we are doing purely liquid computation. We are computing with a liquid, with a pair correlation function of a liquid, and so on. And so it is all this gymnastics of the M, which I guess it's maybe a bit difficult to follow when it has been flashed at you so rapidly. But I wanted to explain you a bit how it goes. Using all that, we get the Dulong and Petit law, which is correct. Oh, sorry, this is just the position degree of freedom. I have not put the p squared, I have not put the velocities. And then we get the internal energy, which is 1.9 plus 3/2 of temperature. And this 1.5, it gives us the energy of amorphous packing. So this is not very easy to get at numerically, but apparently numerically for binary mixtures they find 1.8 at the moment. optimal energy for amorphous packing, so it seems to be quite close. So this is basically it. I will not. One could ask, what is the prediction? Is there another prediction except that? Because in the end, Dulong Petit, it is nice being able to recover it from this very complicated computation. It's not complicated, but from this computation, but it is something obvious. And there is something else, but you have to go to the dynamics. And in fact, in the dynamics, if you look at the out of equilibrium dynamics, in all these systems, there is a phenomenon called aging, in which the correlation function and response function are no longer stationary in time, but they age. They depend on the age of the system. And there is a well-defined modification of the fluctuation dissipation theorem involving an effective temperature that one can compute within this framework, and which turns out that people have seen also in numerics, and I hope that I will see them in experiments. So that is a very non-trivial test, but I will not try to explain it to you now because I would need 20 or 25 minutes, and it's a bit too much. Okay, so that is it. And at this stage, I mean, one can, of course, there is a lot of work that has to be done. I think what I wanted to show you is that there is a rather well-defined framework. This framework, it has, I mean, conceptually, it's not something very complicated, but one has to get used to it. And then within this framework, one can really compute some properties of the glass phase, and they seem to compare, I mean, at least within the simplest approximation we could think of, they give very reasonable results for the glass phase itself. So then at this stage, when one should really improve on all these approximations and so on of the dense liquid, and it's a bit painful because of the theory of dense liquid. Okay, one has to get used to it. And okay.
What is the M dependence that you find?
Oh, it's a complicated. It's a function which is.
What are its analytic properties?
Phi as a function of M. Well, first of all, it has this phase transition here. That is, if you go to low enough M, then it becomes a constant.
That's a diagram. I mean, it cannot be shown on this curve.
No. Sorry. Yes. Okay.
When you have an analytic formula by
the function of M,
analytic expression.
Yes, except that but it involves something which I cannot write explicitly, in the sense that it will involve, for instance, the pair correlation function at the temperature beta M. It involves such things like integral G over R is a pair correlation computed at the temperature T over M times the Laplacian of the potential, for instance. That is the kind of thing that it involves, let's say. Things like that. So it's something which is very explicit, but in the end we still have to put it on the computer and look at its function as a function of M on the computer. It's some very simple things, but I just cannot write a closed formula on the blackboard. I know a few things, but I have not studied in detail.
How does the graph look like?
What I don't know. I would. Okay. No, I have some ideas, but I don't dare to. Maybe I would make a mistake. I prefer to look at it better and give the answer to you. Yes, sir.
You know, if you have liquid, you have viscosity. If you go into this viscosity, pi omega eta, should transfer into Sherman, and you should see this immediately, not just through difficult machinery. Can you give us a hint how it could come from this story?
Well, I think really I have to carry out the next step, which I have not done, and I hope it will be done in the next month or so, which is to go to the dynamics of this thing. In the spin glass case, we learned a lot, we first did all these things on the statics, and it was exactly the same thing, and then went to the dynamics, and that, the dynamics, you learn a lot, but it is something, you have to start really from a dynamical setting, which is something that can be done a priori here. I hope one can just, I have not done it, so I don't want to answer. But it's clear that if one wants to make, and that's the same thing in the spin glass case, if one wants to make close contact to the reality and so on. In reality, the glasses are out of equilibrium. So, I mean, these kind of properties, of equilibrium properties, we can compare them to computer simulations. But then if we want to go to experiments, we really have to develop the dynamical theory for them. So
it seems that it should be like, you know, if the other parameter, as soon as the other parameter is finite, you, at very low frequencies, you switch to
Yes. And compute, no, okay, that is certainly something that in principle we are able within this thing, but we have not yet done it. Should say it's all rather recent. I mean, it's a couple of months ago that we have completed this work. So we have to work out the elastic constants. That's certainly something that can be done.
But you mentioned that FDT is different.
Yes,
right?
Yes.
I think this type of stuff are related to what he's saying.
Yes.
I mean, if you know the FDT, then you probably can answer his question.
Yes, okay, I know it because it has been worked out in spin glasses. It has not been done really on these systems. But the thing that has been done is do the numerical, look numerically at the modification of the FDT in these systems, and they exhibit exactly the same kind of modification of the fluctuation dissipation theorem as has been found in mean field spin glasses of discontinuous type. So that is why I am confident that the dynamical theory can be worked out probably, and we'll find the same thing as in the spin glass, but it has to be done.
I guess I really don't understand the order parameter very well, but can the order parameter distinguish between a crystal and a liquid at fine temperature? Is it a crystal which would have thermoelectric vacancies, and so the atoms do move around, the vacancies move around, single atoms diffuse at long times in a solid.
I think so. If I put the permutation, I think so, because the thing that will the thing with permutation is the thing with vacancy and
can you write down the technical definition?
He's saying diffusion is sort of gauge symmetry and permutation.
But if I take a snapshot,
atoms diffuse in a solid, at high temperature, atoms
yes.
in a liquid.
The difference is quantitative. The difference is only quantitative. It's like several orders of magnitude.
No.
This is what I'm.
No, yes, it's not true. It's not true.
Why not?
No, because in
crystal,
yeah,
I can
sort of treat them as indistinguishable.
So it's distinguishable in liquid also. You can tag it. And people
do that. No, but I don't want to tell. I mean, I am working with with indistinguishable particles. What I just have in mind is the following. Okay, maybe... No, I mean, that's a question which is not totally trivial. The thing I think is that even if you have the vacancies and the vacancies moving and so on, if you look at one given time, you look at the particle's position and they sit...
Snapshot.
You take a snapshot and you have these.
Yeah, in a crystal, they'll be near the crystal site. In the
yes.
liquid, there'll be one atom near each, you know, pretty close to each side of the crystal.
Exactly. Right. Exactly.
I'm not sure how that quantity.
So, yes, yes. And, no. And then if you have the vacancy which moves, it just means that at another snapshot, when the vacancy has moved, mm-hmm. it's another atom which is sitting near to the crystal, but. Globally, if you average over all the atoms and all the positions and take into account this indistinguishability of the particle, you have the same picture. So I think it does distinguish.
Usually what is written in the textbooks, you have to look at
Of course.
Let me finish.
Yes.
And there are good delta functions and low concentration of vacancies.
Yes.
Do not change that fact, that this delta function, it could change its amplitude. And that is the definition which is written in the textbook. Perhaps it is...
But you have some kind, can't you define a long-range order here as well? I mean, you have one copy sitting there, and the other one is ordered with the order defined by a person.
I have no diffraction pattern. I mean, all this story comes because I don't have the Bragg peak, so otherwise I don't need all that.
Sometimes you have a system which establishes what the pattern is, and then you put the second system in and see if it has
yes.
the same pattern as the first pattern.
Yes.
But
yes.
each system has a pattern. Each of your replicas has a pattern.
Yes.
And you're losing it.
No, you're not losing it.
In their
I'm just trying to polarize them in the same pattern. That's what. That's all what I do.
I mean, this is This is a mathematical order parameter, not a physical order parameter.
Right? Well, yes, if you want. No, it is very clear that, I mean, you cannot take the analytic continuation experimentally of a system with time replicas. Yes, I am not claiming it. So if you want, I mean, take it as a... Forget about everything if you want and take it as a recipe to compute the properties of the glass and try to compute the properties of the glass. If you find them correctly, that's not a bad recipe. That's what I'm claiming.
The problem is not whether you define anything rigorously or not. The question is to what extent this definition is stable.
Yes, sir.
Does or does not give you direct connection with different problems. This in conventional second order definition, you know how magnetization gives us immediately spin waves, this, that, you know. And that is why it is operation equation. And I think that all this discussion is to what extent you order parameter serves in the same, positively in the same way.
No, I just understand that. I mean, I'm not saying that I have understood everything about that. I am saying that I have an opening which I think is an interesting one to explore.
Is the technical definition that complicated? Could you write a line there, perhaps again?
The definition of what?
Yeah, the finer
parameter. So we can
solve it.
Yeah, yeah. Infinite and liquid and finite.
Oh. Okay, so I have to take the following
you want
to minimize your thing. Yes, I will come to that. Then I have to say
P of I
C of J.
Well, here I could add or not. So yes, I should add something like this. I'm coming.
So this is something which should be finite in the crystal and infinite in the liquid.
Just a second. And angular braces correspond to
Boltzmann.
To Gibbs.
What is that sum?
Epsilon is the fact. Okay, I have put a minus.
Okay.
And I
should
add sum over all minima.
Yes. No, I have a concern that once. No. Okay.
With the
permutation it is not infinite, yeah. but it does jump I think with the permutation.
Oh, okay, at the first order melting transition between the solid and liquid, this will jump in magnitude, is that what you're saying?
Yes, right. It has a jump.
Sure, the density function. It's finite in both phases.
It's like the density. It's a liquid gas.
Liquid and a gas,
and you say that. Yes, but you can define another parameter by saying it's the density of liquid minus that of the gas.
I didn't quite get it. When you go below. You know the temperature. Do you ever go to the glass phase in this phase diagram? And the answer for the three halves, for example, which point of the phase diagram for the CP that you have?
Here. I arrive from here.
So you never go in the glass.
I just stop at the place where I stick on the 7 point, which is here. But this is the whole trick, that is to access, and here I am below the critical temperature. And the thing that I claim is that by using these M replicas which I have here, I can access this point by staying in the liquid phase. And in fact, my liquid, it's always at an effective temperature which is T over M, which is higher than the real temperature. And that is the real, that's the heart of the method, let's say. The rest is implementation dust. Complicated.
My confusion is, yes, to be able to identify it with any kind of a glass transition, even on a theoretical level, don't you actually need to compute the dynamics and show, for example, diffusion coefficient or viscosity change by tensile?
Sure.
In other words, it's all just a theory of something. To connect with glass.
Yes.
I mean, after all, in study of experimental study, numerical study of glass, the crucial thing is it's really like a liquid, except its viscosity and diffusion constant are compared with solids and like a liquid. I mean,
sure.
Right? I mean, in the end, that's what a glass is operationally. I mean,
I fully agree.
Liquid for all purposes except for, you know, these couple of dynamical parameters for which it is like glass. And it seems you're close to that. You should be able to do that if you understand your thought correctly.
Yeah, well, I mean, as I was telling you, the statics was the first step in this direction, and I mean some of the general thing we know because it has been worked out in the spin glass case, and then I am rather optimistic in the sense that the for instance there is this modification of fluctuation dissipation. If you just say okay, let us look at it, how, and it seems that the modification is exactly the one that one guesses from the solution of the spin glass problem. So I am quite optimistic, but that's still a first step. It's not. I'm not saying I have a. It was towards the theory.
What happened to the specific key?
Sorry.
What happened to the specific key?
It jumps.
So you definitely have a phase transition, whether or not he has.
Does your work parameter jump from a finite large value in the liquid to a small value in the glass? I just want to something else about the work parameter.
Here, I mean, the
is always finite.
Sorry, yes, the thing that, okay, let me explain what we, I mean, how we use it, because that may be the best answer to your method. We use it by studying, okay, we have done two things to use this kind of approach. As I was answering Thierry before, there is one way, which is to take a gas of a mixture of gases of M different types of atoms and start from high temperature, and then these gases, they interact very weakly. This is just this epsilon, so I mean, you don't have, in the limit epsilon go to zero, you don't have correlation between these gases. I mean, they are just diffusing, and then you can look, is there a spontaneous polarization of one gas with respect to the other, and that's one way of defining whether you arrive at the transition or not. Now, if you want to compute the properties in the glass phase, we did something which is slightly different, which is really in the low temperature. We assume that in the low temperature, the thing that will happen is that there will be these molecules in the sense of the fact that the coupling between the replicas has polarized the system spontaneously and has built this molecule. So this is what you have here. I mean, once I write this thing here, I have assumed that I have this polarization. Okay? And that's it. And then I can compute, within this framework, I can compute the properties of the value of A and so on, and I can compute the value of Tg.
Can you compute the order parameter?
And I compute the order parameter.
The order parameter jumps as a from a finite large value or
no,
a finite value in the liquid to a small value in the glass.
Within this framework, the thing that I can do is that I follow the order parameter, which is the case radius as a function of temperature, and in fact it is nearly linear, it's linear in temperature to a very good approximation.
What does it do with the transition?
And then I stop at the transition. I myself stop because I have to change completely my formalism, because I know that at the transition, the thing that will appear is that I don't form these molecules. But then, of course, the basic tools that I've been using, like expanding the small cage expansion, by definition, it cannot be correct in the high temperature phase. No, because I would need to go to an harmonic term, which I have not yet done. it will break. I mean, if I were able to compute more precisely the liquid phase and go to beyond the harmonic approximation, of course I would see it breaking down. But here I don't, because I'm just following. I'm doing like an Einstein model. I mean, I'm not claiming I have done much. I mean, I'm just taking the quadratic approximation, and so I cannot see it. I mean, that may be the answer to your thing. I don't see it jump in the sense that I follow it until TC and I say, okay, then obviously my picture should not apply because I
what determines TC?
Yeah, what is the definition of TC?
What determines TC? This is very easy. It is when my saddle point, I look at this saddle point as a function of M, and when I reach this point here and it sticks, it is a TC. So TC, it really appears as a fact that there is an analyticity of the FDM at M equal 1.
Really check that you have the kind of graph that you're talking about. You really have to identify that TC with something that occurs in your approximation hierarchy.
Oh, okay. Now, okay. That to have a full picture, I would really be, I should. But that is something which is, I think, difficult. At least I don't know how to do it. Yes, that is what I have always said. I'm not able to prove that the things are like that. I'm saying, imagine that this picture is correct, and then I did two kind of computations. One arriving from high temperatures, and one starting in the glass phase at low temperature. In the glass phase, I'm just doing the quadratic expansion of these molecules. And what I claim is that with that, of course, I have access to the transition from this point of view. That is, I know that there is a non-analyticity in my free energy, and this I identify as a transition. But I cannot see the vanishing of the order parameter above.
I would like to follow up to this question of the limit of M. How, if you have a function that's a value is given as the positive integers.
Yes.
Is that uniquely defined? No. Is that uniquely analytic?
Well, you need some more properties like bounded growth. I mean, the fact that the growth is less than e to the minus m squared, e to the m squared, and so on. But okay, that is something if one wants to do it rigorously. But I am not yet at this stage.
You're yes. Assuming there's a big assumption here, right?
What?
That you have sort of e to the n state.
I am assuming, no, I mean, this gives me an idea of a computation that I will do. I have not, then I do the computation and I derive some numbers, some properties, and I compare them to what is seen in the numerics.
Do you have an order parameter? I mean, I'm starting to cover that. Because look, if this is a first order transition like liquid gas,
yes,
it would mean there could be a critical point and you could go around it. So that means you could either have or have not a glass transition, right?
Yes.
And they are not distinguished by symmetry, right?
Yes.
And that may be the case.
It is very clear that it is a very complicated issue in the sense that I have no symmetry to help me in this thing. So in this sense, I am in a,
well,
it's a difficult thing. But I, well, what I say is that at high temperature I don't have these molecules, and at low temperature I have them.
But if you take a molecular liquid and raise the temperature, there's no phase transition.
Okay, that is something. Okay, so that is one point. I mean, as I've said, I have not solved for the whole range of temperature for this system analytically in M. I am just unable to do that. So in this sense, I cannot answer fully your question. But I think this is this is an issue. I mean, what I am able to do is attack from high temperature and attack from low temperature. And I start from very different starting points. I mean, I was saying, at high temperature, I have this mixture of gases which are totally uncorrelated. At low temperature, I start from something which is fully correlated. And then what I just say is that when I do these two approaches, and of course, I push them to the critical temperature quotation mark, and I find something which is very reasonable. I'm not able to prove that it is so.
But to show it is reasonable, don't you need viscosity and diffusion coefficient? I mean, phase transition is just one small aspect of all of glass science. I mean, chemists do much more glass than, right? I mean, so it seems to me you have identified something which may or may not be a phase transition.
Okay.
But on the other hand, it's not clear to me you have identified anything that has anything to do with glass.
I mean, where is in this thing is glass? I mean, which point is point?
Picture here.
Yeah, but that means.
Oh.
I think that's taking stained glass far too seriously than I'd be comfortable with.
Well, that is because as I was trying to explain you in the beginning of my talk, there is a number of. Evidence that these two fields are not so disconnected one from the other, and in fact, using this kind of picture, you understand a few things like the Scoutsman paradox and things like that. That's one point. Then, as I was also telling you, but I did not have time to present, I'm ready to explain it if you want. If you work out the out of equilibrium dynamics of a spin glass, which is something which is not trivial to do and so on, you find a very clear-cut prediction for how the equilibrium dynamics is modified, and you have this very well-defined modification of the fluctuation dissipation theorem and so on. And then people who have looked at it binary mixtures of one over R12 or binary mixtures of Lennard-Jones find exactly the same pattern. That is a very non-trivial prediction. So you may think it's pushing too far, but I think it is the right direction. It's pushing far, but I hope in the right direction.
No, it's very encouraging.
Have you explored the possibility of replicas integrating?
No.
You don't need it.
I hope there is not.
Yeah,
I hope there is not. No, because the fact that there is not, if there is not, it means that I am allowed to do this. If there is, I am not allowed to do that, and then I should find nonsense. Okay, but it might be, I have not explored it. Yes. I think so. Well, anything you compute here is a bit more difficult technically, because you very soon, I guess that you will need to control the four-point correlation function in the dense liquid. And that is, okay.
Isn't there a conflict between the intuition that's based on the properties of spin glass,
mm-hmm.
which replicas imagery is broken? You're trying to apply here.
That's a good thing, but I was trying to avoid that because, that's for our experts in some sense. It is true that in these systems, replica symmetry is broken, but it's broken, as you may remember, at one-step level. Okay, and if it is broken at the one-step level, it means that you can solve this system exactly with the method that I have here, with this value M that I am addressing. The optimal phi as a function of m, it has a maximum, and the value of m where it is maximum is exactly this breakpoint. So in some sense, within this formalism, you are able to find a system, to solve a system which had the replica symmetry breaking, you solve it with a replica symmetry canvas. Because we are working as if we were working inside the blocks that we were having in the replica symmetry.
I'm confused by several comments you made suggesting that one has to do a better job describing correlations in the liquid. But I don't see any reason to believe that you're missing something qualitative because you don't have the right correlations in the liquid. You said one could go beyond HMC, one thought you just mentioned, four-point.
Yes, sir.
What suggests that any other results that you're pleased with, that you get a reasonable TC in these reduced?
I know it is just if you want to push them. I am quite happy to have the results at 10% level, but still, there are a number of questions, and if one can show that if you improve, and instead of taking HNC, you take a better one, or Perkusiewicz, or whatever, you get to 1%, then you are more happy and you get more confidence in some sense.
Well, I think we should thank Mark for a very provocative and fascinating.
Thank you.
The reason I was asking what I was asking is because it's very encouraging what you have. I mean, it's talking is very encouraging.
Yes,
yeah.
Thank you. Thank you.
The questions were.
I got to read it. Now I can read the paper.
Okay.
Which is out.
Yes, sir.
Okay.
Yep.
It's on the web.
Yes. It's July.
Zero.
Look at this.
It's
anything.
That's not DC. That's not this square.
No.
It's
DC.
No.
No.
It's DC.
No.
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 No. No. No. No. No. No. No. No. No. No. No. No. No. No. No. No. No. No. No. No. No. No. No. No. No. No. No. No. No. No. No. No. No. No. No. No. No. No. No. No. No. No. No. No. No. No. No. No. No. No. No. No. No. No. No. No. No. No. No. No. No. No. No. No. No. No. No. No. No. No. No. No. No. No. No. No. No. No. No. No. No. No. No. No. No. No. No. No. No. No. No. No. No. No. No. No. No. No. No. No. No. No. No. No. No. No. No. No. No. No. No. No. No. No. No. No. No. No. No. No. No. No. No.
mean, whether the time scale actually diverges or just becomes very long.
No, that is one issue. I'm not sure it's the most interesting issue.
I agree, I don't think it's necessarily the most interesting.